Good evening, everyone. Okay, now the recorder's turned on. So we're on the journey. And many of us have no idea what kind of journey we're on. We just know somehow we've ended up on this long road going somewhere. In this class, or seminar that we started last week, we're kind of considering a series of pictures and poems from the Zen tradition known as the ox herding pictures. And we're considering how they might inspire, guide, and ground us in our practice. So I'd like to just quickly kind of review the first two pictures that we looked at last week, just to help us approach the third one, because it really, they're kind of helpful. As I said last week, for those people who weren't here, in India, oxen and buffalo, water buffalo, were considered to be very precious and very carefully taken care of. They were considered sacred in the Hindu tradition, messengers of God. And so to raise an ox became a metaphor to work on your divine self, to improve yourself, open your heart to the divine. And then in the Buddhist tradition, oxen came to represent the mind, and then a little bit later, ultimate reality. And then as Buddhism, of course, spread throughout Asia, Buddhists in other countries of Asia made use of this symbol. And eventually in China, the Chan or the Zen practitioners made sets of these pictures of taming of a wild calf or young ox, called, as I said earlier, the ox herding pictures. And there's a series of these, a number of different, or several different series of these. And I'll have this book again out in the back, so if you want to have a look through at some of the different versions, quite interesting. They're a little bit varied. So the first picture, if you have, just look at your little handout there, is a young ox herder, and usually they were young, they were children who took care of the ox, kind of thrashing around in the brush, looking for something. And I suspect she's not sure what she's looking for. Something has jolted her out of her complacency with her daily life, set her off on this journey. And as I said, sometimes we have no idea really what the journey is about, but we're compelled in some way. So perhaps it's a brush with mortality, a near car accident, an illness. Maybe it's the death of a loved one, or the realization that our young ox herder's life as it's lived now is somehow inauthentic. There must be something more. So our ox herder is thrashing about, lost in the thickets, and no path is clear. And this is when we begin to ask the big questions. Why? How? Perhaps we express this by browsing and buying books from the Banyan bookstore. maybe mustering some courage to attend lectures and workshops on spirituality and religion. Perhaps we join a yoga class. And maybe begin talking with close friends or acquaintances about these big questions that suddenly seem so important to us. Then going one step further, engaging in some kind of meditative or contemplative practice. The quality of this particular time and place in our life is a quality of not knowing. And a deep longing that we may not be able to articulate. So in the second picture, our young ox herder has discovered tracks. So something has shifted for her. And I think this picture describes the stage when we begin to have an inkling of something beyond the daily humdrum existence. And really, I think there are so many ways to describe this time or this moment. As many as there are people, I think we all experience it a little differently. But with this inkling, we begin to settle on a path. Our searching and longing has touched something. Or maybe it's much better to say, our search and longing has been touched. And the poem reads, along the riverbank under the trees, I discover footprints. Even under the fragrant grass, I see his footprints. Deep in the remote mountains, they are found. Notice that the ox herder didn't just stumble on the footprints. You know, after deep searching, suddenly you find one footprint, right? It wasn't like that at all. These footprints appear everywhere. On the riverbank, under the long grass, even in the deep, remote mountains. They cannot be hidden. These traces of the ox are marks of something bigger than our notions of who and what we are. Interesting, isn't it? Very little, really, has changed for our young ox herder, but now, instead of being in a dark thicket, she sees footprints everywhere, and they speak with the voice of a larger reality, which is the voice of our true home. Everywhere we look, truth is expressed. There's no need to travel off to the dusty realms of other lands, to quote Dogen Zenji, the Japanese monk who brought this form of practice from China to Japan way back in the 1200s. No need to travel off to the dusty realms. It's right here. There's nothing we need to manipulate. You know, make ourselves better, get into the advanced yoga postures, buy iPhone X, whatever we think is going to do it. Rather than manipulate something, we let go. And I think that's what happened to our young ox herder. Something she let go of. And suddenly, everywhere, there are traces. We let go of notions and concepts of how things should be. How we should be. And then suddenly, everywhere, we notice traces of the ox. To cultivate our practice with this attitude really expresses our innate, our Buddha nature, our innate interconnectedness. All kinds of words to describe it, but really, what do they mean unless we experience it? But that innate quality has been with us from the beginning, and that's why she sees it everywhere. It hasn't been out there. In strong, deep meditation, we see footprints. But equally true, even in our sadness, there are footprints. In our sickness, and in our old age, there are footprints. How encouraging this is. So, just before we move on to the third picture, let's remember that although these pictures are numbered from 1 to 10, this does not mean they're meant to be taken really in a sequence, in a progression. But rather, as I mentioned last time, kind of like spokes on a wheel, or in a spiral maybe, that we return again and again to the searching. We return to noticing the footprints. It's not like once you got it, that's it. You come back. Many times, I think, we come back to all of these different stages or places in our practice. And we do this, I think, until we die. And who knows, maybe after death, we're still doing it, coming back over and over and over again. So let's have a look at the third picture. Receiving the bowl. So the third stage is the sighting of the ox. And we may have a glimpse of its tail or some part of the ox, but usually it's not the whole ox. We just get a little glimpse of something. In the picture, we see only the hind end, or in some pictures, just a little bit of tail. But that inspires us, gives us confidence that the ox is really there. Or perhaps we're not quite clear what we're seeing. Is it an ox or is it a moose? But it doesn't matter, because this is just a glimpse, just a slight glimpse as we kind of peer through the thicket, our vision obscured by the brambles and branches. And the ox seems to be elusive at this point, not showing itself easily. Perhaps the ox is shy. And yet, how comforting is the glimpse. And we are encouraged to deal with the brush that prevents us from seeing the ox fully. Some people in their practice have, or even before they begin practice, have these kind of spontaneous insights. And you know, and I was thinking about this, maybe most of us do. Most of us probably have these spontaneous insights. But they're so fleeting and unrecognizable that we soon forget. Or perhaps we were disturbed by this kind of strange and new experience and quickly kind of move to distract ourselves. Feels maybe a little bit uncomfortable. And when we establish ourselves in practice, we, as Dogen has said, shine our light inward, and allowing the clamor of our mind to settle enough to become aware of what's behind that clamor, what has always been behind that endless chatterbox of our minds. We'll notice a sense of quiet spaciousness and find it restful. And those perhaps stronger moments of our little self, you know, little Michael and dropping away, that they're not so frightening after all, because our practice grounds us. This quick glance is what the ox herding pitcher refers to. And it whets our appetite for more. And it leads us to keep practicing, to go a little further. A little further in our practice. So let's have a look at the poem. And someone would like to read that for us? Okay.
Hear the song of the nightingale. The sun is warm, the wind is mild. Willows are green along the shore. Your notebook and hide. What artist can draw that massive head, those majestic horns? Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Suddenly, the ox herder becomes aware of the song of the nightingale. You know, Kate and I live between Maple Ridge and Mission. And we have a lot of trees around the back of our lot. And on these warm days, I often sit outside on the kind of back porch area and work on doing my SFU class prep or answering emails or writing Dharma talks. And every now and again, I stop. Or something stops me. I'm not sure which it is. And I'm suddenly aware of the bird song and the bird cries. So much bird activity these days. And at night, we hear a chorus of frogs from our nearby ponds. However, it's only when I stop that I really hear the birds and the frogs. Our ox herder, too, has stopped. And now she begins to hear the song of the nightingale, which has filled the forest probably from the beginning of her search. In this poem, she doesn't say, "Oh, I got it. I saw the ox." She doesn't say that. All along, there has been the warm sun and the wind gently blowing, the willows along the shore green. But she couldn't appreciate it earlier. Suddenly, it's there. It reminded me of that Little Gidding, the poem by T.S. Eliot, that famous line he wrote, "We shall not cease from exploration. And after the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and to know the place for the first time." I had to study that in high school. It was pretty painful at that point. But I deeply appreciate little bits that remember come forward again. Now the line, "No bull can hide." Notice it changed from an ox to a bull. I'm not quite sure. I guess because it's the next line is going to be pretty.
It's this translator. It's bull all the way through.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
Okay.
It should be ox.
Yeah. So let's say no ox can hide here. I think this is telling us what we have so long searched for was already in plain sight. One of the hallmarks of our school of Zen, the Soto school, is that transformation is not becoming something else. Transformation is becoming what we already are. And this is one reason why I really prefer the word awakening as opposed to enlightenment. Like a dreamer, a kind of awakening from a troubled dream to the body she has always had, the home she has never left. This, I think, is the understanding of Zen transformation. Does that make sense? So the poem goes on a little bit. "What artist can draw that massive head, those majestic horns?" When I read this, I immediately thought of the water buffalo. Big horns, right? But it's a very docile animal. So I think maybe that's why the translator used bull to kind of give it a little more energy. "What artist can draw that massive head, those majestic horns?" Perhaps telling us there is no language to describe the limitlessness of who we really are. The true source is beyond our thinking. It is pure and stainless. And when you describe it, you put a limitation on it. That is, we could say you stain it, you stain the truth, or you put a mark on it. This is the Zen view of trying to describe the ineffable. But sadly, it seems unless we can name it, categorize it, we don't think we got it. We have to name it, categorize it, and then, now I've got it. We want to be able to talk about it, to kind of fit it into our understanding of the world and our understanding of life. And when we do so, though, what remains is static, and really just an abstraction. Although, I must admit, there is enough literature and writings, enough Zen literature and writings, probably to fill a large library room, a large public library room. There's tons of the stuff, both in Asia and in Asian languages and in European languages. But much of it tells us to leave words behind. Very Zen, kind of, you know, paradoxical. Leave words behind and to free ourselves from the entanglements of what we think we know and just enter the limitlessness of this present moment. Freeing ourselves from our tendency to intellectualize, to discuss it and, you know, categorize it, etc., is also part of our path. Even when we have experience, right? Let go. I have thought this is part of the problem with relationships. You know, we appreciate them so much at the beginning, and then we start thinking that it should go like this. And it doesn't quite go the way we think it should go, and it gets worse after that. The poem goes, the sun is warm, the wind is mild. Willows are green along the shore. No bull can hide. Here no bull can hide. So this ox is always present. In our darkest times, the birds do continue to sing. To glimpse, to hear a few notes, to feel briefly the soft breeze is a moment of freedom. Our practice is one of the senses of the body, one of the body. We're not separate from this body. So please, listen for the song of the birds. Listen for the chorus of frogs. So let's have a look at the next picture too. Catching, what is it called? Catching the bull? Quite a picture, eh? Our poor little ox herder. A bull that, or ox that probably outweighs her at least 10 times. So this picture, I think, is about struggle. But also power and energy. I was thinking about this, that Zen stories often depict struggle as simply part of our practice and part of our human life. For example, Siddhartha, before he became Buddha, fasted to the point of near death in order to find awakening before he gave up all aesthetic practices and took nourishment and then sat under the Bodhi tree in deep meditation. Or another figure, Bodhidharma, who supposedly brought Zen practice from India to China, sat facing a wall for 9 years before he began to teach. Or Daisho Hueko, who's known as the second patriarch of the Zen tradition, who cut off his arm to show his sincerity to Bodhidharma. And today, when entering a formal Zen monastery, monastics will sit alone for 5 to 7 days in the meditation hall or in a more traditional temple in the gateway outside or just inside the Genkan, the kind of entranceway, to show determination and a commitment to practice the way. This is something, for example, if you go to Tassajara, the San Francisco Zen Center's kind of mountain practice center, you sit what they call tangario, tangario. You sit for, was it five?
5 days.
5 days. And you sit all day. They bring you meals, you get to eat, you get to go to the bathroom, and that's it. But you sit all day long. You drink lots of tea, so you keep getting up and going to the bathroom. But otherwise, that's it, right? And well, you can't take a bath for those 5 days. And then, on the evening of the last day, they bring in these kerosene lamps. And you're led out of the meditation hall. You've been told to bring your bath gear. And you're led down to the hot spring baths, which are huge and beautiful. And you bathe by lantern light, by the river, in the hot spring waters. Well worth the wait. So struggle, as we all know, is a part of life and a part of our practice. And what is required for this struggle is a deep determination. The determination to face our stream of habitual behaviors. The determination to really meet ourselves exactly as we are. You know, looking at the picture, we can imagine our little ox herder being dragged around by this huge ox. And isn't it true in our practice, we are dragged around as well at times. Sometimes when we sit, our sitting periods go really smoothly. And other times it feels like hell. And you think, I'm going to go home and watch Netflix. Of course, we're also dragged around off the cushion as well. So often the mind is off visiting some distant realm, and we struggle to return to the task at hand. But this struggle is simply part of the taming. Committed to staying in the present, we become familiar or acquainted with the vicissitudes of our mind and of our life, our life's behaviors. So these distractions and wanderings of the mind, too, are encompassed in the life of this great ox. Taming the ox is to not become constantly entangled, but to remain steady when it's time to be steady. And in this way, we become familiar with our ground upon which we stand. So let's have a look at the poem. Do you want to read that one for us?
Sure. I seize him with a terrific struggle. His great will and power are inexhaustible. He charges to the high plateau, far above the cloud mist, or in an impenetrable ravine he stands. I have abandoned the whip and ropes.
Thank you. Our struggle is to meet the wild currents of our life with the quiet of our heart and mind. The fact that the ox is trying to perhaps wander away, dragging us with it to high plateaus and deep ravines, may indicate that the mind of our ox herder, and of course our mind, is still subject to distractions, which may cause her to lose focus and awareness. Sometimes we struggle with great fierceness, a kind of muscular struggle, like sitting up through the night of a long retreat, all night, often done during the Rohatsu, the December retreat, emulating the Buddha. And it is important to have a sense of one's limits. It helps to recognize both prideful exertions and also careless laziness, really know our limits. However, our Soto school of Zen tends to really downplay the heroic struggle of crushing and grinding down all resistance. Thank goodness. It supports meeting the powerful, turbulent currents of our life with steady, open, and firm heart and mind. As the poem indicates, our mind and our life are filled with inexhaustible power that will at times carry us to high, cold plateaus and deep into impenetrable ravines. The question is then, how will you respond? Will you respond with despair? Will you charge ahead with gritted teeth? Or will you call 911? So the last line of the poem is, I have abandoned the whip and ropes. At some point, the way to struggle is by not struggling. The whips and ropes of our stories about how life and practice should be, how life and practice should unfold, these stories we at some point lie down. Sitting upright, we face into the wind of our life, seeing and feeling it freely and fully, and honoring how little control we really have. I have abandoned the whip and ropes. I also may indicate that our intention and effort to follow the way is now pretty steady. After all, our searching, discovering our way, seeing something beyond our everyday self and struggling with our mind, our aspiration is really firm and unwavering. We're committed to our practice. And although at times we forget and maybe lose touch with that greater sense of self that we peep at, glimpse at now and again, we simply return to our practice, picking it up again, because clearly that is the way to fully express our life. This reminded me of another Dogen quote I wanted to give you here. Dogen wrote in the Genjo Koan, quite a famous piece of his, he said, when Dharma does not fill your whole body and mind, you think it's already sufficient. When Dharma fills your body and mind, you understand that something is missing. Sometimes we may think, life and practice is sufficient. Perhaps some understanding has arisen or some strong experience has happened to you. And maybe what drove you into practice, into really this search, is no longer quite so pressing. Right? Life is okay, going along. Chug, 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 chug. But Dogen clearly tells us here, there is no end to practice and no end to deepening our understanding. Even when Dharma, the teachings, fill our body and mind, we sense something is missing, that the path continues on, around and expand. So tonight, I think I'll stop here. And I'd like us to do just a little writing together. I'd like you to put yourself in the fourth picture. What is your struggle with practice and your life now? What are the ropes and whips of your life? And if that's not enough, what does fully express your life mean to you? So I'll pass out paper and pen.
What was the last one?
Yeah.
What does fully express your life? What does that mean to you? Like often, you know, maybe another way to put it, what is a really authentic life for you? How do you fully express your life? What does that mean to you? And it's important for us to know, because otherwise, how will we know? So I'll read this out again once we get our writing stuff together.
Yeah.
So, would you mind passing those? Oh, sorry.
Yes.